qui ? Eh bien quoi ? Ça dérange qui ? Si j'ai l'œil lubrique, si j'ai des envies de cul, des envies d'aimer, le premier venu, une roue à jamais. C'était quand ? Déjà, notre dernière fois, je ne comprends toujours pas pourquoi tu n'es plus là. Mais quand je suis grise, renaissent les teintes de nos gourmandises, de nos étreintes. On s'aime comme avant, avant qui ou quoi. Les passions s'étiolent, je ne me souviens pas. C'est fou ce qu'on change, c'est fou ce qu'on oublie. Et je me demande, ça dérange qui ? Eh ben quoi ? Ça dérange qui ? Si j'ai l'œil gonflé, les dents jaunies, si je pue la crasse, la pisse et le sang, si mes traits s'effacent, limés par les vents, eh bien quoi ? Ça dérange qui ? Si j'ai les yeux vides, les lèvres bleues, si mon estomac gueule dans mes talons, si je crève seul sous un tas de cartons, assez traîné dans ce purgatoire, il est temps d'aller au diable se faire voir. Ce soir je suis grise et de blanc vêtue, je braille des cantiques que je ne comprends plus. Je prie comme avant, avant qui ou quoi. Ma foi dégringole, je ne me souviens pas. C'est fou ce qu'on change, c'est fou ce qu'on oublie. Et je me demande, ça dérange qui ?
Güneşten gelip güneşe gidiyorlardı. Tahsin Yılmaz, Hicabi Küçük, Osman Akgün de katıldı aralarına. Sevda ki onu eğilmeden taşıyana yaraşır.
Yemo, Yemo.
Solukları derindi. Göğsünde çırpınan ölüm bir yana, Yemo bir yana düştü. Ölümü yenmişti.
So scared, can't even walk in the dark. Won't you walk with me, Jesus? Walk with me, beloved Rabbi. Walk with me, Jesus. I don't want to walk alone. I see piggies and pimps crawling all around, running and fighting to see those evil clowns. Won't you walk with me, Jesus? Walk with me, Jesus. Walk with me, Jesus, 'cause I don't wanna walk alone. Come on, live my prison, peace is my victory. Walk with me, Jesus. Walk with me, Lord Jesus. Walk with me, Jesus. I don't wanna walk alone. By my side, walking with my Jesus keeps me satisfied. Oh, won't you walk with me, Jesus? Walk with me, Jesus. Walk with me, Jesus. I don't want to walk alone.
Fell. Wenn Eisberge krachen, dann bringt mich das zum Lachen. Ich krieg ne Gänsehaut, wenn Lawinen runterstechen und Bäume voll Schnee in sich zusammenbrechen. Verdirbst du mir den Spaß, spürst du Stormellas Hass? Jetzt gibt es kein Zurück vom bösen Meisterstück. Ich schütt den alten Sempel, somit steht so, dass es weh tut. Ich schreie raus, ich hasse Santa Claus, den lieben Santa Claus.
So nett und fröhlich
und immer ehrlich,
wenn ihr mich fragt.
Absolut entbehrlich. Ich hasse Santa Claus. Ja, ich hasse Santa Claus. Das ganze Ho, Ho, Ho und sein zuckersüßes Wesen. Spielzeug für die Kinder. Ich werde es ihm vermiesen. Ich werde ja erst warm mit dem Chaos, das ich plane. Ich schicke meinen schlimmsten Sturm genau zu Santa Claus. Verdirbst du mir den Spaß? Spürst du Stormelas Hass? Jetzt gibt es kein Zurück vom bösen Meisterstück. Ich schütt den alten Simpel so mit Schnee zu, dass es weh tut. Und immer ehrlich, wenn ihr mich fragt. Absolut entbehrlich. Ich hasse Santa Claus. Ich hasse Santa Claus.
Ich mach all den Schnee und er lässt sich's versüßen.
Er klaut meinen Donner.
Ich schwör, das wird er büßen.
Jetzt reicht es.
Jetzt reicht es!
Ich fühle die Verpflichtung, alles zu zerstören und Santa zu vernichten.
Verdirbst du mir den Spaß? Spürst du Stormellas Hass? Jetzt gibt es kein Zurück vom bösen Meisterstück. Ich schütt den alten Simpel so mit Schnee zu, dass es wehtut.
Ich hasse Santa Claus, den lieben Santa Claus.
So nett und fröhlich und immer ehrlich, wenn ihr mich fragt.
Absolut entbehrlich.
Ich hasse Santa Claus, ja ich hasse Santa Claus.
Welcome back to the Santiago Boys. My name is Evgeny Morozov, and I'll be your host. On the last episode, we told you about the day that changed everything in Chile. September 11th, 1973. The day of the coup. The day that ended two utopias. One socialist, one cybernetic. And it caused so much tragedy across the country. With Salvador Allende himself tragically dying while defending the Constitution inside the presidential palace. The lives of others were radically transformed as well, with Fernando Flores ending up arrested and in prison. Stefan Beer wasn't in Chile on the day of the coup, but he's been trying to help his Chilean friends rebuild their lives after it. The government that commissioned Cybersyn may now be finished, but the stories of these two people, Fernando Flores and Stafford Beer, are far from over. And the transformations that their lives are about to undergo will definitely surprise you. Stay with us. A few months after the coup, Stafford Beer simply won't give up on Chile. He's been tirelessly helping his old friends to rebuild their lives after Pinochet seized power. But some of his old allies, some of those friends that he used to meet at the Athenaeum Club, have now switched sides. They're with Pinochet. They're praising the dictator in the British press. And Stafford is furious. He even writes a letter to the Times of London to tell one of his former colleagues off. How dare he defend the brutal dictatorship? Stafford's brother Ian, who does hang out with a lot of the British elites, sees quite clearly that Stafford's passion for Chile has made him into something of a black sheep in that society. Thus, shortly after the coup, Ian attends a dinner party in Oxford. He still attends quite a few of those. And the subject of Chile inevitably pops up.
They were all discussing the future of Chile and what had happened as a result of the revolution. And then they realized my name is Beer. I think it was the most awkward moment, in a way, of my life, because these dons in this college were very anti-Stafford.
Stafford doesn't care what they think. By then, he has already lost faith in his ability to change their minds. Here's what his friend Jonathan Rosenhab thinks about Stafford's conflict with the British society.
He never could be thoroughly a member of British upper-class circles, and possibly by the time he could have got in, he no longer wanted to.
For now, Stafford would continue to play the game, as his Chilean comrades still depend on him, but he won't be doing that for much longer. Meanwhile, on Dawson Island, some of Allende's former ministers are locked up in a brutal prison camp. But this won't stop them from learning new things. How could this be otherwise, right? They're incurable intellectuals. So even in this concentration camp, they somehow keep their minds alive and busy with books and debates and discussions. And then something unexpected happens. A guard feels sorry for them. Sergio Bitar.
The guy said, okay, you have been working the whole day. Would you do something else? Well, we would like to organize a seminar, and I was one of the organizers of the seminar.
Dervish is granted.
So we will have a guy talking about the brain and neurology, another guy talking about teaching English, other one, myself, teaching French.
Even cybernetics, the favorite subject of the Santiago boys, appears on the Dawson curriculum. Miss Fernando Flores preaching the usual gospel.
They discovered this thing about cybernetic there. Probably has an influence.
You may remember that Fernando has always been quite an avid reader. So he continues that passion even inside this brutal concentration camp. His friends are happy to supply him with the most cerebral material. Gibbon Schiapp, the German designer, is one of them.
I knew that he was in prison. Yes, of course. I sent him works of a German philosopher, and he was very grateful for this. Later on, he told me.
All this reading will eventually take Fernando on an adventure that is beyond his wildest imagination. So now, a year has passed since the coup. Pinochet's secret police are still ruthless and very efficient. They even hire experts to do their dirty work for them. Experts like Mike Townley. Remember him? The guy who used to make Molotov cocktails for fun? And spy on Allende's communications? Now he works for DINA, the intelligence service, eager to kill people left and right, with his wife on call, happy to help him in some of those gruesome activities. One of Townley's early missions sends chills down Fernando's spine.
I received a new that a bomb has killed General Pratt in Buenos Aires. I knew the relation that Pratt had with Pinochet. Pinochet was second guy there. I said, Pinochet is never going to kill Pratt. But that time was devastating and can't kill me. Because I knew a lot of secrets about the real relation between all of that. And I need to enter in despair a couple of times in my prison that I believe that I want to be killed.
But Contreras, the head of DINA, is not done yet. Just a few days after the Prats assassination, he strikes again. After torturing some leftists, he finds out where Miguel Enriquez, the feared leader of MIR, is hiding. As Contreras' forces close in, Enriquez has a choice. He can run away and leave his pregnant girlfriend behind, saving his life and continuing the struggle, or he can stay with her and probably lose his life. He chooses to stay. She loses the baby but lives. He dies. But with so much repression going on, even Pinochet's ruthless secret agency is in need of some help. And it arrives from the most predictable source. Peter Kornbluh explains.
In the spring of 1974, the CIA sent a team to Chile to help the young director of national intelligence, the secret police service that Pinochet authorized and created under his friend and colleague Manuel Contreras, become a professional secret police service.
And the CIA's know-how comes in handy in this new Chile.
The CIA team trained DINA officers in computer work. They helped the DINA build an infrastructure for intelligence gathering and counter subversive activities that it was going to engage in. And it stayed in Chile for, I believe, approximately 3 months, supplying training and equipment and money and other things.
It's been a year since the coup, and Stafford is back in India. He loves it there. He feels like he's found his true home. He writes a letter to his friend, Sonia, back in Chile. Stafford says that he might even stay there, in India, forever. He's no longer the British intelligence officer defending the empire. He can actually enjoy everything that India has to offer now. So now he just wants to enjoy its beauty and culture and its vibrant spiritual heritage. Here's what he writes.
I thought of you often as I moved around the villages of Mysore and Rajasthan wearing the simple Indian dress that I love the most. The language is coming back to me fast. 80% of Indians live in those 600,000 villages. There is hope for them yet. I very much want to help them.
Why is he in India? He's come here to deliver an important lecture. A lecture where Stafford speaks up against the rich countries that exploit the poorer ones. He no longer sounds like a management consultant at all. By now he's a full-blown Marxist. Or at least he sounds like one. Perhaps that's what hanging out with all those Santiago boys has done to him. India is just one of the many stops on Stafford's busy itinerary. He's still traveling the world, management consultant that he used to be. Most of it is for assignments of various kinds because he does have to make ends meet. Eventually, though, all those trips, inevitably lubricated with a lot of alcohol, take their toll on him. Vanilla Beer explains.
He had a couple of strokes, and I'm amazed he didn't have more. He didn't sleep much. He had barely rested. He smoked.
Here's Stafford himself explaining his health problems in a letter to Sonia.
This illness business is a problem. It is cardiovascular and affects my limbs and my vision. I also got blood poisoned in the mountains after attack by a plague of mad bugs, which hasn't helped. Doctors told me to stop.
In Santiago, things are very different now. The Chicago boys have been put in charge of the economy, while Milton Friedman, their favorite guru, has even come to visit Pinochet and even take a picture with this despicable dictator. The plan that they used to turn Chile into their free market utopia is called El Ladrillo, or the brick in English. This, of course, refers to its enormous size. And they prepared it while Allende, of course, was still alive. But now that he's gone, the Chicago boys finally have a chance to implement their vision. Unfortunately, all those Santiago boys, the radical engineers around Allende, are no longer in the picture. Thus, the only cybernetic tool that their Chicago-trained opponents will recognize is that of the market. And the Chicago boys don't face much resistance to their agenda. After all, they have guns on their side. No one can stop them, as Sergio Bitar, the former mining minister, points out.
Those guys, the economists that the so-called Chicago Boys, well, they could work only because they had a dictatorship and they didn't care about the circumstances that what happened to the people.
So slowly but surely, they go about undoing everything that Allende did. They make healthcare and pensions private. They kill off the electronics industry that Allende so much wanted to build. They're also busy justifying poverty, inequality, and dependence. Judge Orwell's Ministry of Truth would be proud of their rhetorical achievements. While all of that is happening, Fernand and his friends are still in prison. But they're not on Dawson Island anymore. They haven't moved to another place, a place called Ritoque. It feels a little better there. But not everyone is so excited about it. Francisco Letelier, the son of Orlando, the former defense minister, had this to say about some of his visits to Ritoque.
I remember my very first visit to Ritoque marked me for life. You know, my father was a very respectable man. So me as a kid, to finally see him, to see that he had skin cancer and that his fingers had been broken and that he had lost so much weight.
This place does sound terrifying and harrowing.
So that was a big deal for me to experience that in the short visits we would get to see him. Also a very contradictory experience because unlike Dawson Island, Ritoque was on the central coast, on a beautiful stretch of coast that my father really loved.
And as we'll soon discover, there is more tragedy to come for the Letelier family. After the coup, Gabriel Rodriguez, one of the original Santiago Boys, starts a consulting company. Ostensibly, it's to get rich in this new capitalist Chile of Pinochet. But in fact, this company is just a front for financing MAPU, the political party, which now has been forced to be fighting underground. And Gabriel's consulting company somehow manages to land a most lucrative contract with the Chilean Navy. But before they can finish the job, DINA, the intelligence agency that everyone fears, swoops in on them. They think that the Navy must have been crazy to have hired this Allende loyalists to be working on state secrets. How could they possibly give them access to all these highly classified materials? So, unsurprisingly, DINA arrests Gabriel and they take him to Villa Grimaldi, which is an infamous site. It enjoys a terrible reputation as a torture chamber. It has now become famous all over Chile.
It was a very sophisticated restaurant that was transformed in a place for torture and imprisonment and eventually for disappearance. They took me there and I stayed there for 10 days approximately, living with three other people from the Mir in a closet of one square meter. So we need to do some kind of for sleeping a little bit. One, two of us need to be standing up and the other two sitting.
But then something truly amazing happens. Remember the old rivals of the Santiago Boys from the campus of the Catholic University? The ones organizing the October strike that paralyzed the country's transportation? I'm talking about the so-called gremialistas. Remember, they were the right-wing lawyers obsessed with professional associations and making sure that the government didn't interfere in them? Well, their leader has now become one of the main advisors to Pinochet. All that advocacy and work during the October strike clearly paid off. And his intervention to help his former enemy, Gabriel, probably saved his life. So Gabriel was actually taken out of Villa Grimaldi, released that is, and instead he was sent to, wait for it, Ritoque. So, yes, he finds himself in the same concentration camp as Fernando Flores, his old friend. As unexpected reunions go, This one is very strange.
Fernando and myself, we sit together with the division in the middle, and then he passed me books and we talk about, huh? There were kind of possibilities of doing kind of connection.
And Fernando, it seems, has a much better deal in Ritoque.
We were in the tourist class. It was the business class, the tourist class. We were 200 people living there and mixed.
Gabriel finds Fernando completely absorbed in philosophy and biology. And one of the books that Fernando is reading stands out in particular.
And the book was about something absolutely strange for me. And say, this guy is getting crazy. It's a book in English that talks about the planet and something called ecology. First time in my life I have heard that name. See, this guy is getting magical or things like that, blah, blah. 2 years after that, I understood that he was talking something quite serious.
So, by now you might be asking, what of Project Cybersyn? Well, some of the junior people that worked on it stay in Chile. They start a new consulting company where they use Stafford's ideas. Minus, of course, all that leftist stuff about worker participation and solidarity. None of that, of course, would be possible in this new neoliberal Chile of the Chicago Boys. The military simply would not tolerate it. So it's all about management now. Shortly after the coup, Cybersyn also gets a new boss. He's the same right-wing engineer who brought soldiers to Raúl Espejo's house, dragging him to Corfu. That, of course, was quite predictable. Promotions like this don't happen without a reason. So this new boss wants to know absolutely everything about Stafford Beer and what he has been up to during his visits in Chile. Whom he'd been meeting and why, where did he go, all of that stuff must go into a report that his former colleagues are supposed to write and submit to this new right-wing boss. Has this information ever made it to DINA, the intelligence agency? Well, we don't know for sure. However, we do know that Manuel Contreras, the terrifying head of DINA, the guy who's been obsessed with fighting communist insurgency even before the coup, does reach out to Mario Grandi, Fernando's Italian associate, and he wants to talk to him.
You have been con loco, you con lui, perché non potevi dire di no.
Contreras asks Mario a lot of questions. Questions about Mapu and Fernando Flores and much else. He even asks him to collaborate with this new fledgling intelligence service he is building.
E poi, alla fine, quando mi disse se lavoravo con loro...
Mario, reasonably, says no thanks to Contreras. And being an Italian citizen, he actually manages to leave Chile. So for now, his problems are over. I've talked to a few other Santiago boys about what it is that Contreras may have been up to when talking to Mario. Gabriel Rodriguez, for example, told me that possibly he was really interested in the Talex network.
Probably the connection with Mario is that Contreras was very intelligent. Probably he was looking for what is this cyber scene thing, what is this? And he was told that there was Mr. Grandi that knows about this.
But Contreras has his own plans for all this technology, both Talexes and computers. And these plans promise absolutely nothing good. At least not to Chile's radical leftists. Meanwhile, after all these trips, Stafford's health issues force him to reconsider his lifestyle. And according to Isidora Vanilla, he was right to worry.
If he'd carried on his old life, he'd have had a heart attack and died, you know?
The devastating events in Chile also prompt Stafford to completely reassess his priorities.
Well, he felt that he'd wasted his life. He felt that, contributing to the structure of capitalism was not something that was admirable.
While the revolution in Chile may have failed, Stafford's own personal revolution is just beginning.
The situation in Chile completely revolutionized him. He didn't want the old life back. He wanted a different life.
Writing to Sonia, Stafford outlines his new plan.
You knew all about the contradictions and my determination to change my life, but we disagreed about the means. Since I felt I could not abandon all my dependents. In fact, I did leave Sally because she would not talk about anything and refused that I should change at the beginning of the year.
There are other changes afoot.
I am buying a one-room, 100-year-old labourer's cottage in a very remote situation as my personal base and place of predilection. I want to stay there as much as I can. Sally and the family will also move to Wales, where I can easily visit them.
He's tired of all the luxury.
By selling Firkins, the Rolls Royce and so on, I'll raise enough money to give Sally her house and its possessions and to start a trust fund. This trust will pay Cynthia, Sally and my mother. It will also pay me the average per capita income of my country.
Cynthia, by the way, is Stafford's previous wife, the one before Sally. She's the mother of Vanilla. And to top it off, Stafford withdraws from the public eye, as Vanilla regretfully points out.
He stopped doing TV, you know, and he shouldn't have done because, well, I'm glad he did. But when he did TV, that pulled in clients, of course. It gives you respectability. He couldn't bear it, though.
But as Stafford steps away from the limelight, little does he know that a rock star celebrity, yes, a rock star celebrity, will soon enter his life, bringing unforeseen fame and attention. Meanwhile, back in Chile, Contreras does have a problem. The guys from Mir, those radical leftists, are still out there, even if they have lost their leader, Miguel Enriquez. And they're sneaking in and out of Chile, using their connections to network with other far-left movements all across the region. And Contreras just needs to stop that by all means possible. So he talks to Washington, which he does have a lot of supporters. He even goes there. He meets senior people, people who are engaged in all sorts of military and defense activities in the United States. And after those visits, he comes up with a plan for better intelligence sharing across the whole region. This will hopefully make it harder for all those border-crossing leftists to be so mobile. Contreras also invites spy bosses from other Latin American countries to a big and important meeting in Santiago. And this meeting marks the birth of Operation Condor, which is something of an evil twin to Project Cybersyn. Francesca Lessa, the Italian academic at Oxford, explains.
Condor was a secret operation that was agreed in Santiago in this meeting in 1975, when the military regimes were especially keen to be able to silence the exiles that were carrying out international condemnation campaigns against what these regimes were carrying out in their own countries.
Contreras, having received training in all these advanced technologies during his time in the US, does have a lot of gadgets up his sleeve. And he thinks he can win his war against Mir and other radicals. But what is he planning to do with this Operation Condor? And what kinds of gadgets will prove useful in this deadly mission? A cold-blooded murder in the heart of Washington is a harbinger of things to come. This is Pinochet, abetted by Contreras, going after his enemies. We've told you before about the CIA trying to get rid of Fidel Castro in Cuba. Remember Operation Mongoose and all those other interventions that they've been planning. So, most of them, of course, did not succeed, as we all know. But there is a dangerous aftermath to all those efforts. A rather invisible one. So, after all these people have been trained to overthrow Fidel Castro, they're now roaming many countries, including, of course, the United States, where they're causing trouble.
In 1974, 45% of all violent terrorist acts around the world are committed by Cuban exiles, whether in the United States or outside the United States. So all that they want really is to overthrow or destroy the regime of Fidel Castro.
This is Alan MacPherson, a scholar of Latin America at Temple University. He notes that DINA, the intelligence service run by Contreras, employs some of those Cuban exiles to go after Pinochet's sworn enemies. And they zoom in on the most important of them. This man had been advocating for an alternative technological war order just 3 years earlier in Lima. But now he's in the crosshairs of dangerous assassins. Here's what happens. Orlando Letelier, who endures almost 3 years of imprisonment, is finally released. And you will remember that we met him earlier and quite a few times. He was the Chilean ambassador to the US when whoever it was bugging the embassy. He was foreign minister, he was defense minister, he spent time in all those concentration camps and prisons. So after all that time, he finally returns to Washington, where he previously served as the Chilean ambassador, and he does so with a renewed sense of purpose. He really wants to fight Pinochet, and he has the resources and the connections and the wherewithal to do it. And Pinochet really hates this guy, and he hates all the attention that Letelier's activism is bringing.
Orlando Letelier was considered a threat by the Chileans for a few reasons. One is simply that he was very good at propaganda. He would write articles against the Chileans. He would, you know, disseminate the human rights violations. He was allied with other Chileans who were exiled, and many of them who were not socialists, but they could work with this man who was a very sort of smooth socialist.
Letelier also understood that the Chicago Boys and their enablers like Milton Friedman were actually helping to boost Pinochet's image abroad. So he's trying to discredit them. He's trying to point out that they're actually ruining Chile's economy. They're not building some kind of a utopia that has never been experienced on Earth. In fact, he's even writing articles about it, attacking them, and viciously so. But that's not the only way that he's damaging Pinochet.
The other threat was economic. Letelier was able to convince people to boycott Chile.
Eventually, Manuel Contreras knows that there is only one course of action left. So he sends his trusted Lieutenant Mike Townley, yes, the Mike Townley we've been meeting throughout this podcast, and there are also two Cuban exiles who join him, and they go to Washington to kill Letelier. And they're planning to do it right in the heart of the American capital. Alan MacPherson recounts the gruesome details of that assassination.
On September 21st, 1976, Orlando Letelier is rushing out of the house. He says a quick goodbye to his wife. He gets picked up in his own car, by the way.
Letelier's assistant and her husband are sitting in the back.
Behind them, unbeknownst to them, is a car occupied by two Cuban Americans who have put a bomb under Letelier's legs in the car. They click on a remote control unit, and it blows up his legs and the car. Letelier dies almost immediately, although he's taken to the hospital first.
All of this is happening on Embassy Row, Washington's nerve center of international diplomacy. As Peter Kornbluh points out, at the time, the American capital was not at all used to such acts of violence and terror.
This act of international terrorism still ranks, besides 9/11 here, as one of the only times that terrorism has actually visited Washington, D.C.
But as for America itself, there is bitter irony in all of this.
This was an act of state-sponsored international terrorism from an agency that the United States and the CIA had helped to train. So we actually assisted the actual agency that then sent its agents to Washington to commit this horrible atrocity. And so that's part of the history that we really need to know more about.
The FBI finds Letelier's briefcase after the explosion. Turns out it's full of secrets and letters, some of them to and from Beatriz Allende, some of them concerning the activities of the anti-Pinochet movement, where Beatriz is also one of the leaders, alongside Letelier. But then a prominent journalist twists those letters in order to make it look like Letelier was actually getting money from Fidel Castro. And that, of course, could damage the reputation of anyone fighting Pinochet in America. So who was this high-profile journalist? You will be surprised. It's none other than Jack Anderson, the guy who broke the ITT scandal, helping Allende. In a dark twist of irony, just a few years earlier, Anderson was actually collaborating with Letelier when all those ITT memos came out. Remember, Letelier then smuggled them to Chile and had them published as a best-selling book, all of it thanks to Anderson's investigative work. And now they find themselves on opposing sides of the conflict. The Cold War was truly strange like that. These are the kinds of intrigues that Stafford Beer is no longer interested in. For him, stepping away from the world of advising Western governments and corporations has opened up a new lease on life. David Whittaker, a bookseller and one of Stafford's new friends, observes his incredible transformation.
When Stafford was moving to the cottage, he decided to destroy all his correspondence and masses of his stuff in a bonfire. You know, he was having some kind of a breakdown, and this was a cathartic action for him to start afresh. And he said a great weight was lifted, but the bonfire went on for days and days.
David discovers Stafford thanks to his love of, you'll never guess, rock music.
We go back to 1972 and Top of the Pops, and Roxy Music appeared on there with their first single, Virginia Plain. And I was 17, by the way, living in Ireland, and I really liked the look of them and the style. There was nothing like it ever before. And I particularly picked up on the character Brian Eno. So I started following his career and buying all his records.
David, something of a Brian Eno fanboy, hangs on his every word. And then one day, in an interview, Brian Eno mentions a certain Stafford Beer and all his cybernetic theories that apparently influenced him more than many other musical and artistic approaches. David is truly intrigued, like probably many other readers of that interview. And he just can't let it go. Now he needs to find out just who that Stafford Beer character is. But how did Brian Eno find out about Stafford Beer? Well, one day, Brian gets a book from his mother-in-law. Here he is himself telling us that story.
She came back from Chalk Farm Library with a book she'd taken out for me. And she said, "Here you are, Brian, I think you'll like this." And the book was a book by Stafford Beer called Brain of the Firm. And she was absolutely dead right.
To Brian's surprise, he just can't put down this book.
And I absolutely absorbed that book. I can still quote quite a few sections from it. It was exactly what I needed to be able to think about this particular piece of music that I wanted to write about.
Brian eventually finds the courage to reach out to his hero. "I'm a musician whose main output is albums of rock music," he writes rather sheepishly, as if already imagining himself as a cybernetic factory of sorts. For Brian, being an artist is in fact akin to creating a well-oiled machine, which runs seamlessly and with little interference. By then, Brian knows that the impulse to control every aspect of the creative process is probably as bad as the Soviets trying to plan their economy. He likes to set up some rules and conditions for his art, but that's pretty much it. Then he just wants to let it happen on its own, and with minimal intervention. I don't know if you've noticed that, but this is more or less how Stafford himself wanted his ideal factory or government to run. Some planning, yes, but much of it happens in the process itself. As problems emerge, as instability develops, a clever manager, or in this case, a clever artist, steps in and resolves the crisis, or tweaks the situation to make it more advantageous to the system itself.
There was one sentence in Brain of the Firm that really stuck with me. I think it goes, instead of trying to specify the system in full detail, you specify it only somewhat, and then you ride on the dynamics of the system in the direction you want to go. I thought this is a whole different way of making art.
And to Brian's astonishment, Stafford not only responds to his letter, but eventually he shows up at his doorstep in London, and it's quite a sight.
Well, he felt sort of like a giant to me, because he was broad-shouldered with this huge head of hair and this enormous knitted pullover, which sort of came down to his knees. It was in one of those very thick, sort of peasant-like organic wools that he seemed to favour. So it was like a tent had arrived at the door, a tent with a head sticking out of the top.
Before long, Brian returns the favor and makes his way to Stafford's unassuming cottage in Wales. It's nothing like the lavish mansion that Beer used to live in. But as Vanilla points out, her father was very happy with the simplicity of it all.
Yeah, he just loved the place. It was very quiet. It was miles from anywhere and very silent. He had no phone.
Stafford has finally escaped the trappings of mindless consumerism.
He made his own furniture. I'm talking to you from his table. And his chair is here along with another table and a footstool. I'm very proud of those.
Let's just say this lifestyle is not for everyone.
It was very charming, the whole sense of self-sufficiency, except, of course, that the water had a dead sheep in it, so that was unusable.
Dressed to the nines for a fancy dinner, Brian Eno heads over to that cottage. But as soon as he gets out of his cab, two massive poodles are charging towards him.
It was a filthy day. It was muddy and wet. And they were like two four-legged paintbrushes. And they ran down the drive and jumped at me, both of them. And I was immediately... All my smart black clothes were covered in mud from head to foot. So I arrived at his door looking a complete mess, which he didn't even seem to really notice, actually.
After the rain clears, Stafford invites Brian to take a spin in his Rolls Royce, a memento from the previous life that he's been living. As they cruise around, Stafford becomes increasingly philosophical.
We drove in this car, talking all the time. Mostly he was doing the talking. And at one point, I had sunglasses on. It was a sunny day by this time. It had been wet when we started. But he turned to me and he said, "Why do you filter reality?" And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Those glasses." He said, "You should be grateful for all of reality coming into your, you know, into your body."
Soon, Brian discovers that the days of Stafford's extravagant transatlantic feasts, remember all those dinners he's been having flying between London and Santiago, are long gone. Now all those meals are replaced by a much, much simpler diet. But the drinking and smoking are still there.
And he was talking really quite intently and quite a deep level. And he was chain-smoking these big cigars, like big Cuban cigars. And he had a bottle of sherry, and he was chain-drinking the sherry. He didn't seem at all drunk, by the way. He obviously had quite a tolerance for alcohol.
In the middle of all that smoking and drinking and talking, Stafford gets up, apparently to put a pot of water on his old-fashioned gas stove. He's trying to cook something, but Brian is not at all sure what that might turn out to be. In the meantime, the room where they're sitting is getting steamier and steamier, This cottage now looked like sauna.
No attempt at tea had been made at this point, and the place was absolutely full of steam. So it was a very small cottage, very low ceiling, you know. There wasn't any ventilation. So it just, he was only sitting across the table from me, but he was getting dimmer and dimmer in the fog. And plus, he was smoking this cigar like there was no tomorrow. The place was just completely steamy.
Hours later, the only thing brewing is, well, instability of some kind.
Finally, the saucepan boiled out completely, and he went back in and put some more water in and put it back on the gas. And then, after a while, he said, "What about some food?" I said, "Great," because I was actually quite hungry by now. But